The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
And we're back here on Analyze This, a Power Hour, a two-hour edition for April. Check this out. Programming notes for tonight. Friday, April 19th on WTJX Channel 12. We got the PBS News Hour from 7 to 8. Washington Week with the Atlantic from 8 to 8:30. This is not the Washington Report. That was last night. Okay, this is Washington Week with the Atlantic. 8 to 8:30 in conversation with AARPVI from 8:30 to 9. And then we got great performances from 9 to 10. Explore the work of two legendary music virtuosos, Niccolo Paganini and Robert Johnson. I learned the Paganini when I went to University of Miami, man. And that was cool. That music class I had there, right? That music theory class. And then at 10, next at the Kennedy Center, enjoy performances from renowned jazz saxophonist Joshua Redman. And then I'm Important Company from 11 to midnight. Of course, you know, time turned forward back in March, so it ain't a midnight deal anymore, right? So the PBS News Hour at 7, Washington Week with the Atlantic at 8, in conversation with AARPVI at 8:30. Great performances at 9, next at the Kennedy Center at 10, and I'm Important Company from 11 to midnight. I got my good friend, Kyle Fleming from the Energy Office, Energy Office Director.
Morning.
Joining me this morning for the Power Hour. Late last week, we heard of a decision by the Water and Power Authority, of which you are the chairman of the governing board, that we would have rolling power outages beginning that weekend. It actually didn't start until, I believe, Monday or Tuesday. So something happened over the weekend.
Well, it was different on St. Croix and St. Thomas.
That's what it was?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm. So it was slated for the weekend where? On St. Thomas or on St. Croix?
Over the weekend was on St. Thomas. Mm-hmm. And that was, like it was stated, it was due to the inclement weather, which delayed fuel delivery,
yeah, okay.
which has occurred. I mean, we've dealt with that in the past, but okay, the ships can't come in.
Okay. So that's what it was, right? In addition to the fact that we got some dollar issues that we're dealing with, that we always deal with.
Okay. I think maybe the key takeaway there is that, you know, for us, obviously, as a semi-autonomous agency that obviously serves a community, both, you know, all entities involved, all of our business is done with commercial entities, right? Mm-hmm. We don't deal with other government agencies when it comes to our fuel supply or anything like that. So dollars are, timing of dollars and distribution of dollars is very critical, especially to being provided the commercial services, whether it be fuel supply, whether mm-hmm. it be power generation, that we then in turn deliver to our customers.
Vitol provides what for the people at the Virgin House?
Vitol provides propane fuel supply. As it currently stands, they provide the infrastructure in which that fuel supply is stored and delivered to power generation on both St. Croix and St. Thomas. So they have a kind of multiple tiers of kind of involvement in the delivery of propane to the territory, both from the physical fuel itself and the infrastructure that allows our generators to actually burn it and turn it into electricity.
Is it the government's and the Water and Power Authority's position that we want to sever ties with Vitol and manage the operation on our own?
I guess
that decision, an official decision, been made by the board with respect to that via vote?
The decision was made in April of last year to, the intent was always to eventually own the infrastructure that was built, right? Remember, it was, this whole thing started as essentially Vitol fronted the capital investment to develop the project with the intent that we would pay it off, you know, essentially financed the construction and development, and mm-hmm. we would eventually pay it off and own it. What we've been trying to do is essentially fast track, instead of paying it over, you know, incrementally, at a relatively high interest rate over a 10-year period. It was, let us try to, lump sum, right? Like, say we pay off a car or pay off your house, mm-hmm. you know, if you put more towards it, we try to pay, we're in the process now trying to pay upfront to acquire that asset, as opposed to paying at a high interest rate over a long period of time.
we made an appeal or petition the federal government to use some of our recovery monies to address that. Are you at liberty to speak to that, or that's still secretive, for lack of a better term?
I don't think it's been, I mean, it's definitely public knowledge, not necessarily recovery.
It was $140 million or thereabouts request of the federal government to set aside funds so that we could, for lack of a better term, buy out our current arrangement with Vital.
Right, which would again fast track our repayment of the costs associated with building the infrastructure. The intent, and I think we've communicated that as well, is that owning the infrastructure wouldn't necessarily, we wouldn't be operating it. We currently have a third party who manages and operates all of the fuel delivery logistics, which I sit in that control room, and I assure you everyone on this call will have a greater appreciation for these. These aren't just like, you know, tanks or, you know, like you have your propane tank or your diesel tank, for your generator. It's not just tank that you simply pump fuel to the generator and all of a sudden it's there. Mm-hmm. There is a pretty complex, supply chain, even from just the infrastructure itself to get the fuel ready for combustion. So there's an independent third party that operates that, and the intent would be once this transaction is completed, that third party would continue to be who operates it. So it wouldn't be necessarily WAPA employees, at the onset that are the ones responsible for that. They would still have a service provider that makes sure the continuity of the operation of the infrastructure to leverage the fuel is available.
Okay, good. Now, I want to make sure that the public understand what we're talking about with respect to what we gain by buying out the remaining portions of the agreement with Vital, right? And I want to put it in lay people language.
Yeah.
You go to the bank for a loan, right? You're borrowing $10 million at 15% interest, right? And you're supposed to pay this back over 2 years, right? So the 15% is $1.5 million, right? Midway during this loan, right? So in total, you're paying back $11.5 million, mm-hmm. right? Plus insurance, whatever that cost be, mm-hmm. right? But let me leave out the insurance for now, all right? Midway during this 2 year window, right? You go to the bank and you tell the bank, I'm gonna pay that money, I'm gonna pay off the rest of the loan now. Which means that up to that point, right, the midway point of the loan, of that $1.5 million in interest, you should have paid $750,000, right? So by buying out, right, paying off the loan at the midway point, you're saving yourself $750,000 in interest payments, right?
Right.
That's the same application we're talking about here.
Same application. You're trying to pay off more of the principal as opposed to the principal plus the interest.
Plus the interest.
That's really what really ends up, burning, especially if you have a high interest rate over, a lot. This was a 10-year plan as opposed to like a 2-year. So
good.
That's really intense.
Current agreement with Vital runs to up to a year.
The current agreement for fuel supply or for the infrastructure?
Both.
Well, it was a 10-year, I'm trying to think when that started. I think it might have started in 2018 when they completed it. Maybe it was 2016, 2017 when they started it.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have gone, if we had been on the original 10-year track, we'd be going to somewhere around 2028, 2029.
Somewhere around
on that 10-year track.
Okay.
Obviously, we've been trying to go through the early payoff process for some time now. It hasn't been an overnight.
And this agreement was announced in July of 2013. Just to show you how fast time to fly.
But remember, that was just when the kind of process had gotten in place. The infrastructure wasn't complete and available to us to use.
I'm just talking about the original agreement announced was in July of 2013, right? And then we've had some modifications subsequent to that,
right?
Amendments to the deal and all that stuff. So if we, and I believe the federal government, understanding what took place in Puerto Rico, don't want that to happen anywhere else, right? So, but we don't get into the details with that, right? But the point that I'm making is, if monies become available, and let's say by June 30th, right? is fully approved and the government, as requested of the federal government, that money's made available and we tell Vitel we're ready now to buy out. What happens beginning July 1?
Right, so beginning July 1, we would have, so that's kind of perfect world it.
Best case scenario.
Yeah, we'd be in hypothetical. So now the difference is we've now removed with that payment put off, we now have removed the obligation to pay that monthly, you know, principal plus interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer on our balance sheet. Mm-hmm. It's no longer a cost obligation. So there's kind of immediate savings there. We've also had, you know, an asset that would have been otherwise we would have had to pay for has now been paid for by somebody else. So it's a full cost structure that we no longer have an obligation for. So savings there as well.
Mm-hmm.
We also have now a situation where, yes, we still have someone operating that infrastructure, but one of the major changes that owning that infrastructure provides, not so much on the operation side, but it really diversifies our options relative to fuel supply. So right now, the only fuel supplier we have is Vitel. So they own infrastructure. They're the exclusive supplier that can bring fuel to that infrastructure. So, which means whatever the cost of, and you know, whatever
they
their
own,
costs
they,
are.
They own the commodity or they're buying the commodity?
They buy the commodity and then resell it to us.
And then I resell it to us. Yeah. Okay.
So the commodity cost really doesn't change because the commodity cost is commodity. Like almost no one's going to really get fuel at a much different cost. I mean, maybe they get it, maybe it's fractions of a percent.
The market is what it is.
The market is what it is. Yeah. But there's, you know, but different, you know, different suppliers may have different economics relative to delivering the fuel to us, whether it be the cost of the vessels that they own or that they're chartering or the approach that they have for fuel delivery. And what that does is, to get away from the complexity, it just gives us more options, right? The same way we're looking at having options in our fuel supply, right? Remember, it's kind of in that same zone. They talked about the same time period. They talked about having multiple fuel sources so we could, you know, burn different fuels. So you have a more diverse portfolio of options, the same way we look at from renewables and having a diversity of options, not just being reliant on one fuel source.
Yeah.
Being able to go to market if there happens to be a supplier, right, that can provide a better rate of fuel delivery, we have that option. We don't currently have that option now. And so that's, and let's say, for example.
Let me ask this question as a ratepayer. What's the priority now? Options or efficiency?
Efficiency is definitely number one. But you still need.
You passed. You aced that test. You aced that test so smooth. Check. Because that got to be the priority now, man. Like efficiency got to be number one, right? Now, there are variables that get you, right, to that efficiency that you need. You know what I'm saying? To include options and all that stuff.
Yeah, right? I mean, the thing is, and why efficiency is important is because regardless of who your fuel supplier is, right? I mean, yes, maybe, again, like you may have a 5 or 10% maybe swing on different fuel supply. Let's just stay high level, perfect world. At the end of the day, the less exposure you have to a volatile market, the better, right? So the less volume of fuel we need, whether it's from whoever is supplying it, that stands to reduce our cost to provide our service. So efficiency is number one because, again, it's limiting our exposure. The less of that volume, the less volume of that fuel we need, the better cost structure
we're going to have. The reason why people don't want to deal with WAPA, because they don't want to have to deal with all of the maintenance and all that stuff that come with solar and all of that. You check, that's why WAPA is still a viable option, you know. People really ain't got time to take on that responsibility.
And
you check, of managing infrastructure and all that stuff. But at the same time, you can't blame them. Because cost is real.
We've made the business case a little bit too easy over the years for whether it be businesses or residents alike to take on more than they would otherwise. You know, they're no longer running their core business. They're now having to invest, you know, a significant amount of time, resources, operational bandwidth into power production, and that it's I still stand by it. It's still
I like how you incorporate bandwidth as a part of it. You use that as the noun, right, to explain what we're dealing with. By the way, that the man that had called the show about his deposit, did you ever look into that?
No, you know, we never actually got any progress on that front.
Because he was a little concerned about why his deposit was so voluminous
compared to what his usage
compared to what his monthly payment is. You know what I'm saying? And Clifford Graham, my finance chairman, had reached out to me and was explaining to me and all that stuff that I got a formula in place based on size, capacity, and all that stuff. That's how they arrive at that number. But then there should be some value over time showing that I ain't really using that amount of capacity, mm-hmm. so an adjustment is made. So I just wanted to ask a question. I hope he's still listening, because you know we want all the listeners to hold on, and I don't want him to think that I forgot that important question there. One of the things Senator Nelson had mentioned doing his research at the time was micronuclear, right? He had used that right? And Wallace Williams just asked a question, right? Hold on there. I can respond to this question here. What Wallace Williams had asked about the feasibility for micronuclear. I know we're a small island, he mentioned that as well. Is that totally off the table?
Not totally off. I mean, I think that that brings in its own other spectrum of complexities as well too. But it's definitely not off the table, but I assure you it's not something that's being heavily pursued. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because that was something that during the congressional hearing or the subcommittee hearing that participated in last week, the Republican, constituents that were there or representatives that were there were asking about, well, they were pushing for both natural gas, coal, and nuclear, all resources that are abundantly available and leveraged in the continental United States, none of which are present here in the U.S. Virgin Islands. But small modular reactors is actually what they typically call it in terms of the nuclear options. Mm-hmm. Nuclear is always kind of a nuance, I guess, resource. You know, there is a lot of it in the U.S., but there isn't a lot of recent development of it, right? So all the nuclear power plants that you see in the U.S. are all over 30 years old. I think maybe Georgia recently had some announcements for one, but there's so much, regulatory challenges and environmental concerns. And even though they're making it safer and making it more, it's obviously been made far more safer, far more controllable. There's still a lot of stigmas there. I always tell people what's interesting. I don't know if most people know this, but like France, for example, is like over 80% nuclear.
For real?
Yeah. Wow. And that's longstanding. I mean, this is not nothing new. They went all in on the nuclear tip early. Mm-hmm. The thing for us, and again, it kind of comes down to, I always look at it from a location standpoint, right? Because now you're talking about, it's one thing to, we already see the complexities of bringing just standard fuel, whether it be diesel or propane, into the territory, into this remote island nation. If now we're talking about like the transport of a, well-known volatile fuel, not necessarily from a cost standpoint, but like volatile, like physical fuel source, that come with nuclear, and that you're talking about not just being able to deliver it here and then also having to deal with the waste once that fuel is spent and then transporting it back to the state. So now we're adding, I think that's probably the biggest concern. How do you make that logistics make sense?
The logistics. We'll take a break, be back right this, and we're gonna actually talk about the topic I just brought up a little while ago with respect to WAPA being an option for a lot of customers. Be back right after this.
Bank of St. Croix has something for everyone. With two locations, the Bank of St. Croix provides personal and business checking accounts, online banking, and mobile apps for banking on the go, a nonprofit community investment checking account, and a 24-hour banking cash management platform. Bank of St. Croix, Gallows Bay, Bank of St. Croix, Peters Rest, and online, bankofstcroix.com. For details about our nonprofit community investment checking account, our service specialists are ready to help. Bank of St. Croix, member FDIC.
Sometimes you need a moment to just step back, relax, and listen to your favorite song. I'm Raina Duris, and on the next World Cafe, maybe I can help you find something new to love, or maybe remind you of something you've been missing. There's so much music out there to enjoy, so take a moment, take a breath, and tune in to World Cafe.
Weekdays at 10 p.m. on WTJX-FM 93.1. So I spent the past year trying to figure out what news designed for 21st century humans might look like. One of the things that really stuck with me was that we now know that humans actually need hope to get up in the morning. And I don't think as a journalist I ever thought about it that way.
We're always looking for new and better ways to understand the world we live in. That's On Point with me, Meghna Chakrabarty.
Weekdays at 1 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
As the news gets more complex and changes through the day, you need more than just a quick headline check. Here and Now keeps you connected to your world between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as the news and the people shaping it are changing in real time. I'm Robin Young. Follow along on Here and Now, NPR News weekday afternoons.
From 2 to 4 on WTJX FM, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
And we're back here and analyze this, and we're talking about the realities of the water and power situation here in the Virgin Islands. So I just made a statement with respect to, and I want to make sure I contextualize what I was saying, where people are still willing to do business with WAPA. Right, even though we've had many Virgin Islanders who have found alternative forms, and the majority of that alternative form is solar, right?
On the residential level.
On the residential level, right? On the business level, a majority of people know
they're still burning.
They're burning, right? They're still burning, and but some going with generators though.
Yeah, so they're either burning propane or
pull
diesel.
Pull the microphone a little closer to you.
They're either burning propane or diesel.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I can give a ratio on which one, but I think I've seen more propane. I need to talk about like whether it be supermarkets, hotels that are doing their completely running on their own. It's a mix.
So one of my listeners refers to him will say, "You are totally wrong about the last comment referring to what people are willing to do to maintain their own power systems. People have apps to manage their solar system, right?" So I said, I countered now. So we have a discount season, mm-hmm. right? I'm walking and chewing gum the same thing, right? I said, what percentage of the population is on WAPA as opposed to yourself and others on solar, right? So maybe that's a study I could do, or I got a number now, right? If you don't have it now, Kyle Fleming, right? And I also told him I was speaking from a generic perspective. And so he said, if everyone was able to afford solar and don't have the albatross of a bill, it's a no-brainer, especially where that cost impacts a lot of economic decisions. I wasn't speaking about that, but I was speaking about the convenience aspect, right? So I said, people are already predisposed to paying for services. From a convenience perspective, mm-hmm. they love a ready-made circumstance. And the majority of ready-made is WAPA, right? When I buy a house, I want to know if it's connected to the pole, so I go get power and I got assistance, or I go buy water from WAPA. That's what I meant. Yeah. I'm not knocking those who have solar. I never said that. I'm just saying I'm willing to bet that the majority of the residents in the Virgin Islands are connected to WAPA and not managing via the solar. I'm not knocking solar. You have every right to go to solar, and if it's economically beneficial for you, you had better go that way. I'm cool with that. I'm just saying, knowing the numbers that I know and the realities on the ground, a majority of people are down with WAPA, and it's because of a convenience aspect, among other things.
I'll take the hot take here and very confidently say that 99% of people, even those that have solar, are still connected to WAPA. The extreme minority of people who are 100% of residential mm-hmm. that are 100% off-grid is incredibly small. This is not, most people think they're off-grid because they have solar.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. They are still connected to the grid. Even if they have a battery system, they're still connected to the grid. Even if they only use the grid occasionally, they're still connected to the grid. So there is a lot of misconceptions out there. As a former solar developer who's installed them and met with hundreds, not thousands of people, but people, as they've gone through the energy decision that they're looking to do,
uh-huh.
the perception is if you have solar, you're somehow now no longer reliant on the grid. And yes, there are people who are completely off grid. They have said they turned the breaker off or they've cut the line. They certainly exist. But that minority is so small, so small. And there may be a network of people
Should we be working to make that number bigger?
For them, for those that are for, I mean, there may be different sides of that take, right? There may be people.
Because here's the deal. The initial investment is what's really attractive about going the solar route, right? You spend that money for the infrastructure because you want to reduce what you're paying monthly, right? So you're paying monthly for what? Management of the infrastructure,
right?
Not necessarily as much for energy.
Yeah, and I just want to be sure. My distinction I'm making is not about people. That's what I'm talking about, people who are completely off-grid. I'm not sure the person you were messing with before. I don't know if they're one of that extreme minority that are completely off-grid.
Yeah.
But if there's a WAPA line coming to that house and there's a breaker there and it's on ready to serve them at any time, they're not off-grid. And it's very clear. But again, a lot of people have misconceptions. So I just want to make – I'm talking specifically
No, that's what we're doing. We're educating the public now. So I'm cool with that. Yeah. By the way, I suppose I got solar field up East End.
That's been under development.
It's been in development. And so it's under development right now. Mm-hmm. And that's where?
Salis Fancy? Petronella, I think, is the area. It's over off of, right across from the Boy Scouts.
Up there by Howard Wild Boy Scout Camp. When you bank the car now and you're starting to head back.
To the dairy farm.
Yeah. And then the left-hand side.
Left-hand side right there. Right across from Great Pond.
So how is that working out?
We did a tour. I think they had some claims that they're going to be.
That's a WAPA lease. A WAPA lease arrangement.
It would be a power purchase agreement.
Power purchase agreement.
Similar to the Spanish Town Farm and the Dunno Farm.
How did Dunno Farm doing in St. Thomas?
Been up operational for the. As far as I know, they put out about 5 mm-hmm. megawatts or so peak. There today, so it's been operating.
And by the way, Dunno.
Yeah, I don't even try to say that name, especially in St. Thomas.
When you think of it, think of D-O-O-N-O-O. Dunno, right?
I'd rather say the farm by Home Depot. Just save the hassle because I can always.
That's the Dunno. That's the Dunno farm. Me and Leslie Commission had some fun with that one as well. The watch sellers, what's the deal?
So right now, phase two of the Wardsville. So phase one has been in service for quite some time. Phase two, we're still working through getting to the final stages of commissioning phase two of the Wardsville, which is 36 megawatts.
So when we're talking about phases, we're talking about amount of megawatts that being made available and getting coming online. I mean,
yeah, because we already have Wardsville. So
we already got Wardsville. They actually came through for us at a time when we were struggling last year, right?
Yeah, they did. They did pick up some load. Those same years that picked up some of that load are actually, we're still in the fight. Like, you know, turning on a generator.
What load percentage is currently in play with the Wartzellers?
Right now, they have with phase one, which was the one that had been installed and in place for probably like 4 years. Those account for at peak, 27 megawatts.
Okay.
If they all are dispatched,
okay.
Phase two would account for 36 megawatts.
Additional 9, or
each unit is 9 megawatts.
Okay.
So there's
megawatts. Yes. So right now we're at 3.
Yeah, it's on the on the original stack of generators.
Yeah. How many total generators are we looking at? Wartzellers over there?
It would be 7.
7.
Yeah.
So that means maximum capacity was 63. If we're going 9 megawatts per,
if they're no, but the per first generator? the first phase actually was 7 megawatt units. Now the second phase is 9 megawatt.
Oh, okay, so yeah. they're different levels of megawatt units. Yeah. Okay, good. Can I just want to make sure the public know what going on?
There's a lot of generation changes over there, and those are all the reciprocating. You know, going in St. Thomas, they went away from the gas turbines to the reciprocating units. Which are the Wardzilla. And so we're hopeful to get the second phase of Wardzilla, which includes 9 megawatts, 18 megawatt hours of battery storage at that site as well. So we're not just looking at, it's not just generation exclusively, it's a hybrid of generation and energy storage, all of which work to improving reliability, improving efficiency of the generation dispatch.
And what about reducing costs?
That's all inherent to it.
Okay.
That's all, like, so the efficiency piece is what is what allows us to, one, being able to burn propane as well as the lower cost fuel, as well as being able to require less fuel to provide the same amount of power is the efficiency reality that comes from those.
Question from a listener, because you know I like to, you know what I mean?
Bring them in.
I want the audience to know how important they are. Good morning, Neville. Listening to the WAPA discussion, please address this if possible. With the abundance of sunshine, why aren't all streetlights solar? Is it is difficult to drive these roads at night? Thank you. Now, at night, you got no sunshine. So how do we go about addressing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we had, if you recall, before the storm, we had this approach to adding a panel to each street light or each pole with the intent to try to offset the cost of running those lights, you know, at night. Mm-hmm. That's when they needed. So each basically would
be. So in our best case scenario, what happens? We generate battery energy during the day and we use that to provide the power at night.
That could be for example, if you see lights on, whether it be on the boardwalk or over by the airport, them. I think UVI has them. That's how those are. That's how those are set up, right? Mm-hmm. You can see, like, usually a large box or a moderately sized box on the top of the post, and then so that's what you do. You would charge if you had that type of solar light configuration. That's what you would be deploying. You know, you see that in parking lots.
That's a term. That's what I'm looking for. The configuration.
Yeah,
that's a term. Yeah.
But in terms of streetlights, we have not looked at a we haven't had a public street light where it's a solar and battery street light. We've had the ones where we just attached a solar panel to the pole. That did not work out very well. As you can see, most of those battles were lost in the storm. It's oftentimes
Text me. St. Thomas was 100% solar street lights before the storm in 2017.
Yeah, and then we lost almost all. Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of a challenge to that.
So why not go back?
I would not. I personally would never go back to. Because
of hurricane storm potential.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I tell you right now, it's not the most efficient way of offsetting the operational cost of a light in that way. I would argue that yes, if you did a solar and battery light, but then the thing is that those are very expensive pieces of equipment. So if you were to think about how much it would cost to do the entire territory with a solar and light battery, can it be done? Of course, there's a number out there. There's always a number that can solve a problem. But that would certainly be a high cost investment to deploy that at the scale it would need to be deployed. Because we're not just talking, again, you look at UVI parking lot, you look at the airport parking lot, that's a very confined space. Mm-hmm. Trying to deploy an entire territory-wide network of solar and battery lighting, yes, the cost on those systems have gone down. And I would say, I'd be happy to kind of pull up maybe what a potential cost would be maybe for the next show. To show what if that was to be the approach, given the current inventory of light posts that we have in the territory, if we were to try to convert all of that to standalone solar and battery light fixtures, what that cost would be. I can anecdotally say it's going to be untenable, but I would like to quantify that.
But then again, remember the governor was the one who said that he'd like for all the house them, right, to be solar power driven. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So with him saying that, maybe there's a collective mindset now that we are fully committing to solar like Barbados did. Yeah. When Barbados bragging now about how they printed money because of what they did with solar some 20 plus years ago.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is when it comes to, again, like things can be done, right? But like part of the reason why you see lights the way they are right now, right, is because when you have a pole that already has, you know, electrical lines running to it, it's far easier to just get a light and couple to an existing piece of infrastructure, whereas what we talking about here would be putting in a completely standalone, separate piece of infrastructure. Again, anything can be done. There's a cost associated with it, and I think that's what takes something from being an idea. Yes, that's a great idea, but then how do we overcome the cost associated with that and make that realistic, but it can be done. There's no question. Yeah. There's no question that theoretically it can be done.
And then there's a maintenance deal going forward.
There's definitely a maintenance deal. Yeah. But again, but we know we need street lights. We talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, what's your name? Yesterday?
Gabriel.
Yeah. He was on the show and he said, we're taking care of Melvin Evans Highway, so yep. that they're going to be lit.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a beautiful thing, you know, once the highway lit. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? And it's about confidence building anyway, you know what I'm saying? It makes you feel good, right? So we're good with that. St. John, good. What about the generator in St. John?
So they've still been continuing to work with FEMA on scoping that project. That's mm-hmm. been one of the many federally funded kind of journeys we've had to mm-hmm. go down in terms of.
That's a bittersweet thing talking about that to me, because it was John Griot who was the one who told me about that in my early days here.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And Jan and all that stuff. And, you know,
Yeah, so no generator there yet. Not, you know, not going to pretend anything else. But we've been in competition.
But the concept was sound, though, where we don't want St. John to be dependent on Randolph Hawley to provide power in the event of the worst case scenario being revisited.
I mean, the reality is that concept of moving generation closer to the actual loads is not just a St. John approach. It's with everything that we're trying to do. Whenever we're talking about,
St. John situation is special. They have, you know, we've been looked at and they feel like, you know, real redhead stepchild. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And in this case, this particular move, which is a brilliant move on behalf of the administration, to get a generator over there so that while we're in recovery mode, they're not dependent on Randolph Hawley. And the cable. Remember, there's a cable now.
Yeah, right? the subsea cable there, and you have substations. Cable. I mean, if you just think about the distance that the power has to flow to get there, it's its own journey. And yes, again, getting it closer to the load on St. John, that was the initial concept. And the concept isn't in question. It's really more of exactly how it's going to be implemented.
No, they said, when they were doing the research, they realized they found there was a graveyard. I was like, I think some graves or something.
No, that was actually on the undergrounding.
The
undergrounding had that issue.
In St. John. Okay.
The site, what was originally looked at was, and you know, we may still end up reverting to that anyway, but what was originally looked at was a generator in Cruz Bay and a generator in Coral Bay.
Oh.
That was what was originally scoped, you know, like, you know, post-storm.
I thought they were one big deal, one little dick.
So they were
thinking about one on one side and one on the other.
Yep. Okay. That was what was originally proposed and kind of discussed what's been on in, you know, as they've gone through attempted implementation there. You know, some challenges arose, so we've been working with the federal partners on, you know, if re-scoping to allow for a more streamlined implementation of that generator, maybe it's strategically in one site. That to your point, that's still reverse.
By the way, the person who asked a question about the abundance of sunshine, we're moving on up. That cell phone number is a North Carolina cell phone number. I ain't gonna give out the area code and number, but I just wanted to know that we got people texting us with.
Coming from abroad.
Yeah. They're probably here in the territory now. Yeah. But when I saw the area code, I said, it ain't a 340, so we're doing good. We'll take a break when we come back. We will now talk about the Department of Energy, the Energy Office. You know what I'm saying?
And
tell us what's going on going forward. We'll take a break and be back right after this.
There are many complex issues that arise in our territory.
Comes with the Territory with Leslie Comision.
Join me, Leslie Comision, for a breakdown of political issues facing our territory, one conversation at a time. I'm here to be the voice you can rely on for information that is straightforward and comprehensive. Tune in to be a part of the discussion. It all comes with the Territory.
Comes with the Territory airs Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airs at 7 p.m. on WTJX-TV, Channel 12.
Stay updated with news, alerts, and other valuable information with WTJX Newsfeed. Get the latest news stories that matter from veteran news journalist Tom Ader. Just download the WTJX app or online, WTJX.org. WTJX Newsfeed, your source for stories that matter.
I love this song.
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Peter Sagal. You spent the week listening to the news. Don't you think you deserve to show off what you've learned on Wait, we give you a chance to impress your friends with your knowledge of international incidents, political gaffes, and the latest advancement in German nudists. You'll be the life of the party, or the death. Either way, you'll make an impression, and you can thank Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. right here on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
I've never seen this. This is amazing.
On Finding Your Roots, Brendan Fraser.
My great-granddad?
Yes.
Was a candy salesman?
He was a candy man.
Yes!
And Valerie Bertinelli.
They kept so many secrets.
An ancestor's anger ends in violence.
That is your ancestor shooting another man.
That's a criminal.
And an unknown marriage uncovered in Italy.
Whoa, wait!
Yes.
That's not Angelina.
Tune in April 23rd at 8 p.m. on WTJX-TV Channel 12.
And we're back here to analyze this special two-hour edition of the Power Hour. I got my good friend Kyle Fleming.
Is this our first 2 hour?
No.
We've done 2 hours before,
we've
right?
We've done okay, before, yeah, but we don't do it regularly.
Yeah.
We want to spoil me or the audience. Because I like this kind of conversation. I think we had one with Johnny Robson. Remember when John was...
Oh, that's right. Yeah. We got the history. We got the then and now.
Old tech discussion.
Yeah.
Right? One of the things the energy office has been big on is batteries. Mm-hmm. And... maybe we need a town hall series, not just a town hall, a series of town hall meetings to promote battery use. And the fact that cell phones are dependent on batteries being recharged, I think that could be a impetus or a catalyst for getting the public to be more battery use inclined and embrace it going forward.
Well, I can't tell you how good of a segue what you just stated is, because you know, as we're about to get into this section, talking a little bit more about some of the programs Energy Office has in the pipeline.
Yeah.
One of the programs that we're excited to launch and will be launching here, we're targeting before the end of this month, and the timing is also kind of key given the challenges that we've been encountering on from a disruption, electrical, you know, disruption reality recently. We have a program called the Virgin Islands Battery Energy Storage Rebate Program. You know, we've historically given rebates for appliances. People are very familiar with those for, mm-hmm. you know, energy efficient appliances. Earlier this year, we launched our rebate program for electric vehicles, where we're giving $5,000 back for people who purchase new and used vehicles. We have almost 10 people who've already taken advantage of that program, so we're already seeing an increase in electric vehicles through that. And so taking that same pattern and strategy of utilizing our federal funds to lower the barrier for accessing some of these both efficient, resilient, and electrified options, we're going to be doing the same thing for batteries. So we actually have a residential, we focus on residential rebate for energy storage installations. What we're really trying to target is, and this is focused on batteries. I know people are thinking like solar and batteries, but at the end of the day, if you had a battery in your home without any solar, this past week would have not been as uncomfortable for you. We realized that reality.
Mm-hmm.
Having a battery can be, even if it's charged with the grid, means that when the grid goes down, you still have resiliency. You still have power available to you without having to rely on a generator. The technology has grown immensely in that because there's so many more batteries going into utility scale projects, residential home batteries, vehicles. The abundance of batteries is much higher now. The configurations in which they're available, especially to the community, is growing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at incentivizing. We're going to be offering essentially $300 per kilowatt hour. So if you have a a 10 kilowatt hour battery system, we'll be providing a $3,000 rebate through this program. And it's
I know you're on the right way, becoming an engineer. You're just watching you very, very keenly, then listening to the details. And that, it looked like that one was appetizing to your ear, yeah. You know what I mean?
And what's great about it is, you know, the reality is we have a lot of vendors already who have been well-versed in deploying batteries, because batteries are very commonly deployed with solar throughout the community. But what we're focusing on here is batteries independent of solar. You're not having to exclusively be tied to solar, but having a battery in your home. My mom, I put one in my mom's house. This is maybe 3 years ago, but she didn't have any solar on, and it was just so that way, anytime the grid went down, she immediately had power backup. You think about that. This applies not just to homeowners. We're actually looking for you know, apartments as well, too, condos, because at the end of the day, some people can't put solar on their home. Even if you think you're living, you're living in a condo unit, a multi thing in St. Thomas, a lot of multi kind of family configurations. You know, maybe you don't have a roof space available, or the roof is owned by one, and not everybody has access to it. But you could still have the benefit of resiliency. And the target there is to make sure that these systems are tied directly, so you're not, when the power goes out, it automatically provides backup, whether it be to the whole home or whole unit, or critical circuits in your home, whether it be your refrigerator, your lights, your water heater, your water pump. That's the kind of target use case that we're going to be seeing.
Now, let me ask this question now. What about those instances? I mean, it can't satisfy every situation, but a storm is pending. You're charging. Storm hits. You got some power. It ain't gonna last forever.
That won't last forever. So that's a very different use case.
That's the extreme negative use case we're talking about.
Yeah, in that scenario, you would still need to have something to recharge, because if the power's out for days or weeks, you're gonna need something. But if you think about, like, for example, look at the rotations that have
exactly
like, they've been 2 hours.
So it'd be perfect for the current situation that we're dealing with now.
Perfect for a current situation, and perfect for the normal. You know,
that's what I'm talking about.
When power normally goes out, it's 2-3 hours. 6 hours.
Yeah, power could go. I mean, we could have a perfect. Like, we got it's perfect outside now.
Yeah.
And it's going to be that way for maybe the next day and a half, whatever. And then Sunday, a confluence of things could happen. A storm come in. Next thing you know, WAPA got to turn down because you check. So that's what you're talking about.
So we're trying to deal with the most common, like trying to address the most common pain point, which is the intermittent disruptions that do occur throughout the year. And, you know, again, and the there's more affordable technology that addresses that, and what we're trying to do is make that readily available technology even more cost effective for the community. And the other thing is, when we look at our incentives, we always are able to stack them. So for example, we offer a direct rebate for the investment. People also have the ability to take out the batteries now under the federal policies, also are available for tax credits. So you can be able to leverage our incentive, our rebate program, for immediately, and then still have an additional incentive, additional cost offset that could come from the federal tax credits that apply to energy storage installations in homes as well too. So it's all about bringing the cost down. We know that the community has an appetite. Nobody wants to be disrupted. We're trying to bring the cost down to distance people from the reality of disruptions, right? Like I said, so this is a program we're really excited about. Again, it's in line with the other programs that we've been launching and rolling out to continue to lower the cost barrier to adoption. And this one, I think, especially given the recent challenges, I think speaks even more directly to trying to distance people from the reality of those disruptions. And we're excited to get this one out.
By the way, if you got a call from St. John Rescue, it was because I recommended your agency to them.
Okay.
Because they were looking at grants. And I told them, well, one agency I know that embrace, grant submittals, submissions and all that stuff is the Energy Office. And they've had excellent success.
Yep.
The governor actually came out commending you in that regard. So, we're going to take advantage of that. Because this is the grant window. And the current administration, the Biden-Harris administration, they are big on infrastructure, more so than any administration we've seen in a long, long time. And all of them are interested. Even the ones that I didn't support, Trump, Pence, I'm sure they're all interested in infrastructure. Some are just more, got more verve as it relates to wanting to see it happen. Well, and this administration, every time you turn around, they're bragging about microchip this, $50 billion for this, $10 billion for this. It's amazing.
Well, that's why we try to align our programs with what we know the federal government is willing to support, right? So all these programs, all these incentives, they're all based on federal funding, opportunities that we've went out and when we go out and apply and when we go out to propose the type of projects that we're going to utilize with these funds, we know the appetite for the administration and we align our goals with that. Those goals also happen to be aligned with the local needs and the local pain points, which makes it a more symbiotic exchange. And so it's great for us to leverage that. And again, we're going to continue to speak to those appetites. And by having more funds, like in the years before, we couldn't really offer these programs because we had such limited funding. You know, we could do a program like this, maybe only be able to put $50,000 towards it.
Yeah.
Now we're going to be able to put over $800,000 towards
over half million.
Multiple. Yeah. And that means we're going to be able to touch more homes. We're going to be able to have more people that benefit from this cost reduction in improving the resiliency of their homes. And that's one of the reasons that keeps us very enthusiastic and inspired to keep going after these funds, finding ways to creatively make them available. So as I said, this is something that we'll have a ton of information on our Facebook page and on our website. Tell the community to keep tabs on our social media outlets, specifically our Facebook page, because that's where we'll be announcing the rollout of these, amongst other media as well. But that's always our most immediate path of communication. And I think this is definitely going to be a program that speaks to many. And we're also happy that there's an appetite for it in the community. And there's already a list of vendors out there that can support and deploy these type of technologies. So we're excited about a very fast track deployment and realization of these benefits with this battery technology.
Let me ask this question for my audience, because we look at everything. We look at globally, hemispherically, nationally, regionally, and locally, right? The Biden administration, Biden himself is not big on fossil fuel. Yet, at the same time, the U.S. is currently producing more oil than any country ever has in history. Reconcile that for me, no? When they say that we're producing more oil, what I mean? What are we doing? More drilling? That's what we're doing?
I mean, it's either more drilling, more production, just or more wells are continuing to produce, and we're extracting as much as we can. I mean, you made a statement earlier.
Our reserves are big. We're in Alaska?
Still in Texas, Colorado. You got natural gas coming out of Pennsylvania to Louisiana.
Yes. We still fracking?
They still frack.
Okay.
Yeah, they still frack.
North Dakota and South Dakota and all that stuff.
Actually, I play. It's funny enough. I met somebody here playing tennis. They're from Pennsylvania. They actually their home happens to sit on a very productive shale fracking operation, and you know they're probably enjoying a lot of their life here now because of their strategic location.
You were going to reference something I mentioned earlier, sir.
Oh, well, you talked about chewing gum and walking at the same time, and that's kind of while the Biden administration is very much so pushing for the planting the seeds for the next wave of evolution in terms of strategic renewable and energy storage investments and manufacturing investments, at the end of the day, we still have to survive today, right? We still have to be able to make do with our current realities, and so being able to produce fossil fuels that's not going to be removed from our day to day in an instant. So while we can maximize those opportunities, remember too that production also puts tax funding back into the whole mix. So I think that there's that it's not necessarily a dissociation. It's not one or the other. It's a parallel track. Remember too, we export fuel too, so it's not just always for our own self-consumption. This could be exported as well, so that way again this drives funding back into the mix.
Why do you think America has done so well compared to the other G7 countries in terms of getting our economy back on track? What do you think? And I want to tap into that brain of yours in this last couple of minutes here. I know we don't like to give ourselves some credit, but isn't that partly resilience and wanting to get back to normalcy quicker than everybody else?
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting that you say that, right? Because I feel like I've been getting into a lot of, for whatever reason, World War I, World War II, fascinated, right? So I look, I've been watching a lot of documentaries, movies, yeah. I kind of keep absorbing that information because, you know, it's not like this is a new thing for the U.S. Exactly. To be this kind of leader, and especially you think of them as being truly a newer a newer entity than most of the other entities, you know, countries that we've
been. We always feel like we're better than other people, so we always comparing ourselves to them. I was talking to Zeno. Zeno said when he went to MIT, it was 50% Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
MIT. He said yes. Yes, we're 2% black, 50% Chinese, half Chinese, and the rest. So in other words, now that explain why China had this development revolution. You know what I'm saying? Because it makes sense. You know what I'm saying?
They think they've leveraged a lot of, building on, I think you look at where the Chinese are now in terms of, especially in this energy revolution, right? Like, very clear that they've taken, like, for example, like, electrification. They've taken vehicle electrification to a whole nother level. And, you know, where it used to be, there's this concept of like a assumption of like cheap Chinese, where they're now like, you know, the number one electric vehicle supplier to Europe is China. Like it is a complete funnel of production. Vehicles that people don't even realize are made in China and sold in those markets. We don't get them, obviously. You go around the Caribbean, it's actually very interesting because you see them there as well.
They really had a plan, a long-term plan for world dominance. World influence, if not dominance.
I think they realize that their production power across the full spectrum of whether it be consumer goods to the materials that go into consumer goods, they've strategically align themselves with being at some point in the supply chain of just about anything that we touch.
When I heard that they were done in Dominica, I said, well, my engineer shaking. I said, yeah, he said, and they're building highway down the road. They know what they're doing.
They do, it's kind of a different, it's a modern day imperialism.
They got a failed venture in Freeport in Bahamas. They wanted to do some development in the Bahamas there, and that one didn't pan out
as well.
But I think that was because it was too close to America.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, yeah. From a proximity standpoint. So they really, after they looked at it, they said, you know what, let me move on. Hey, look, man, great conversation. Glad to see you. And congrats last week on the testimony.
Yeah.
In front of the subcommittee there, and expecting big things as all. Well, tell moms I say, hey, look, man.
I will, man. I'd be remiss. Actually, I was going to touch base on we do have a ribbon cutting for the St. Croix Educational Complex microgrid next week, Tuesday.
This is 4 days from today or the following week.
This upcoming 23rd.
The 23rd. Okay, yeah. Good. Okay, you got
it. So we'll have that as another highlight. We'll see some communication going on that. So
that's a
lot moving at the energy office and in the territory as a whole. So thank you for the opportunity.
Great. My power hour today. Thanks to the audience
power
for the questions. power 2 hours. Yeah, yeah. Enjoy the weekend, folks. Talk to you on Monday. God willing. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
He said that black smoke was constantly coming out of the burn pits 24/7. And my reaction to it was like, wow, that doesn't sound very safe. I wonder what that's about. And in my mind, I couldn't imagine at the time that type of system operating could potentially harm our service members.
Journalism that seeks and reveals. That's On Point with me, Meghna Chakrabarty.
Weekdays at 1 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
Morning Edition takes you across this country and around the world with stories that keep you informed and the context to understand what matters. The news comes at you quickly, but we slow it down to examine each story from different angles and give perspective on what might happen next. A brand new day comes with new possibilities and a new edition of Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays at 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1.